Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen, and this is February 25th, 2016. 24th. What was I thinking? Okay, anyway, and I want to talk about mindfulness. This year in this group, we're going to focus on mindfulness. It's all the news these days. And so the first part of the year, I'm trying to lay out some practical foundations. Tarne, when she was guest teaching, also gave something of an overview. And after some, you know, a few more presentations that are foundational, we're going to slide more into the first of the four places to establish mindfulness, mindfulness of the body, which actually has lots and lots of powerful implications. Tonight, I want to talk about how mindfulness works in terms of the brain based on research that sees pathways whereby mindfulness is beneficial and clusters those pathways into four groups. It's pretty neat material, both because it's kind of cool about the brain and it's research-based, and also because it gives us places to look in our own practice as opportunities for greater mindfulness. So I thought I'd hold forth a little bit and then open it up for discussion. And as usual, we'll try to end close to 8:30. And I'll happily stick around and talk to people afterwards as well. Okay? Great. All right. So four major pathways identified in your brain, in your embedded in the nervous system, embedded in the body broadly, which is, of course, embedded in life and nature and reality altogether. Four major pathways in the brain whereby sustained present moment awareness, which is the fundamental definition of mindfulness, sustained present moment awareness of the inner and outer world, that the cultivation of that quality of awareness, the breadth of it, the depth of it, and the continuity of it, has four major ways of bringing benefit to ourselves and rippling through us out to other people, other beings, not just human people. Our cat, to me, was definitely a person. People. He just couldn't speak very well. He's like a very intelligent four-year-old without language. You know, that was our cat. But anyway, and fur. But so what's the first path? The first pathway is the regulation of attention. William James, the godfather of psychology in America, said over a century ago, the education of attention would be the education par excellence. Because if we don't have control of our attention, if we're not able to drop it on something that's beneficial and useful and keep it there, or disengage it from those things that harm us or through us from other people, we don't really, we're not autonomous. We don't really have our own life in a lot of ways. We're out of control, fundamentally. You're familiar probably with the famous saying from the work of the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb, neurons that fire together, wire together. You know, our experiences are continually changing. The old line was, you are what you eat, right? These days, you are what you pay attention to. Because attention is both a spotlight and a vacuum cleaner. It illuminates what it rests upon and then sucks it into your brain. And if we don't have some kind of regulation over that vacuum cleaner, all kinds of crud gets sucked into the brain, particularly because it's biased to overlearning from negative experiences. The brain is like a sponge. One half of it is very, very absorbent to sludge and sewage and all kinds of nasty poisons, right? That's the negativity bias. The other half of that sponge is absorbent, but it takes a while. Things have to sit there a while to really, really sink in, unless they're million-dollar moments. That's the negativity bias of the brain. I refer to it as like Velcro for the bad, but Teflon for the good. So where we place our attention and what we do with what we place our attention on is really, really important. It's interesting that a very reliable finding is that long-term meditators, people who really engage mindfulness practice in a realistic way, you know, 40 minutes today, 20 minutes tomorrow, no minutes the day after that, guilty conscience, half an hour the day after that, over time, literally build up tissue in the cortex, the outer wrapping of the brain, in regions behind the forehead, that are involved in the top-down regulation of attention. People literally become more able to steady their own mind and reduce distractibility and deepen their concentration, in part through building up, literally thickening layers of cortex, adding new synaptic connections, new existing connections get stronger and more sensitive, and capillaries grow toward these busy regions right behind the forehead, bringing supplies like oxygen and glucose to them so they can do their work. It's like working a muscle. You repeatedly work a particular muscle, it gets bigger. And in proportion to it getting bigger, it's able to do more things for you and through you, helping other people as well. Okay? That's one major pathway whereby regular practice, informal and formal, strengthens our ability to regulate attention. And on that point, something we'll definitely be getting into, I really encourage you, if you haven't, to explore what's called concentration practice, or shamatha practice in a traditional word, where you deepen in your ability to really, really sustain attention to some object, like continuity of attention throughout the inhalation, followed by the exhalation, followed by another inhalation, breath after breath after breath. It's not so much that the breath itself is important per se as an object of attention, obviously you're doing it, but that finding some object of attention, it could be something besides the breath, like a word, like peace or love or om or God, or a feeling of love or joy or gratitude, whatever it might be, through repeatedly training in that steadiness of mind, you really build up the concentration power for ever more penetrating insight. And that's a topic we'll definitely be pursuing as this year unfolds. A second way that your own training in mindfulness, repeated engagement of mindfulness, bringing a wandering attention back, a wandering mind back, again and again, informally and formally. So you're recollected. That's the root of the word for mindfulness in the language of early Buddhism, recollectedness. Isn't that cool? You're recollected. You're present rather than forgetful or mindless. Okay? So a second major way that mindfulness changes the brain for the better is it helps us be more able to sustain activation of networks on the side of the head, lateral, they're called lateral mode networks because they're on the side, mainly on the right side for right-handed people and half of all lefties who have language on the left and gestalt processing, thus imagery, visual processing on the right. People who routinely practice mindfulness become more and more able to disengage from the default mode network in the middle toward the back of the cortex, which is where we go when our mind is wandering, often involving negative preoccupations. They buzz people routinely in studies, you know. What are you doing right now? Is your mind wandering or not? And about 50% of the time for the average person, they're lost in space. And for the average person, more often than not, the content of the wandering is negative. Some kind of anxious, worry, sense of pressure, tension, stressing about something, irritated, you know, work in a resentful case against others as our mind kind of wanders. So it's, and in proportion to the degree to which a person's mind is wandering, they tend to be unhappy and over time, mentally unhealthy in some sense. So a little bit of wandering mind, totally normal, not such a big deal, probably serves some beneficial function, but a lot of wandering, saturated with a lot of negativity, a lot of crud is getting sucked into that sponge of your brain. Because neurons that are firing together while our mind is wandering are wiring together as well. So people who repeatedly practice mindfulness, informally and formally, have less activation of these midline cortices that are the basis for a wandering mind, and more stability of activation of networks on the sides of the brain, especially right-sided, that help us sustain present moment awareness in the now, typically without a lot of judgmentalness. We're discerning, but we're not getting all caught up in our judgments about things. And there's a less sense of me, myself, and I when these lateral networks are being activated. we're tending to take life less personally, be less defensive, be less preoccupied with our own positions and our own possessions. Pretty good. Okay? I'll move on to the second major pathway. Second major pathway of benefit of mindfulness training over time is through, it's called body awareness. And that's because for many mindfulness practices, awareness of the body is a common object of attention. But it's also the case that if you're engaging present moment awareness, especially if you're sitting quietly and your mind's not wandering, you tend to be quite aware of the body because that's where sensation is occurring, especially the sensations of breathing. So through growing attention to the body, people build up cortex, it's layers of neural tissue, indicating increased synapses and other beneficial processes in neural structure or function in a part of the brain called the insula, which is on the inside of the temporal lobes, so two of them. And we use the insula to tune into ourselves. For example, if you notice right now that as you breathe, it's a little cooler coming in than it is going out. Just notice that little temperature differential. You are engaging your insula. If this was the 22nd century and we all had our little mobile MRI, you know, like our, you know, mobile smartphone or whatever, Fitbit, you know, it'd be like brain bit. You would just see, bingo, little activation in that part of your brain in real time, the insula. Pretty cool. As people repeatedly tune in to their bodies, using what's called interoception, the internal sensations, their gut feelings, what's happening in the viscera, the sense of the internal expansion and contraction of the chest. Well, they're repeatedly working that muscle of the insula. They build cortex there, literally. So then they become more self-aware. That's a major benefit of mindfulness practice. Foundation of self-awareness is body awareness. Higher level cognition upon sensory motor perceiving. As we become more in tune with ourselves, Samuel Bonder puts it, as we wake down, not just wake up, we become more aware of ourselves, understanding, knowledge, that's lots of things together. That's pretty good. And as other studies say, as we become more and more we become more able to empathize with the feelings of others. So it's a bonus thing, right? As we understand ourselves better from the inside out, we're able to understand others better from the inside out. And interestingly, as we get better at understanding them from the inside out, that feeds back and even from the inside out. That's the second thing. You might be asking yourself, how am I doing with attention regulation? Is my spotlight vacuum cleaner apparently what, regulated? Or is it bouncing all over the place? You know? Or is it so easy to hijack that certain thing? Like preoccupations with, you know, envy of one kind or another, you know, or food or something like that, or resentments about other people, or in my case, my to-do list. It's probably my main object of addiction. So it's therefore where I have to pay a lot of attention that I'm not being too hooked these days. Shoot me up with task completion. Anyway, that's my primary fix. Lining out one more item on the damn to-do list. Anyway, okay, that's it. All right, third one, I'll just keep rolling. Desire regulation, including the desire to as people move themselves, they also become more able to practice. So if you know yourself better, they get your knowledge. You know where your hot zones are, you know where your tricky needs still are. You gotta be extra careful when you're skiing moguls or going home for the holidays or being in a situation where people are doing something that you don't want to do anymore because they're doing it. So that's useful. self-knowledge is a basis. Having a honey tip that a poison can drawn in and bite that. So if we're able to step back and deal with emotions and we're staying in a relatively stable, neutral place in the core, while at the same time being aware of the core. And what that gradually does is it starts associating quality of peaceful, calm, centered stability with emotionally upsetting or quote-unquote negative material, which gradually starts associating that sense of being undisturbed by it, not reinforcing, disengaging it, with gradually deepening. That's very true. Same thing with desires. Desires may arise, cravings arise at those times. We deal with them. And we stay in our flesh. We stay in our own sleep. And we don't give way to them, we give over to them, we give up to them, take us over. And what happens over time is we recognize more and more. These feelings can arise and they will pass away. Fourth major pathway is a changing sense of self. That's what it's about. And in other words, we often start out, we think there's some sort of unified being inside, looking out through the eyes, the nervous feelings, the raising the back. Same one every day. I go to sleep, the same I go to sleep. We have to go to bed. And while that's a very common experience to have, on a very close inspection, remind you, you start noticing people. First thing, you notice that all kinds of stuff is happening. All kinds of desires, all kinds of views, sub-personalities. It's a zoo. Say, you know, it's kind of wild, we're like a crazy village, you know, on psychedelic, it's amazing, wow, in there. So first of all, the sense that there's some chairman of the board, chair of the board, some conductor, some screenwriter, some director, some film director, inside running the show, starts to fall into that, it become more and more clear, it's a collective. Without any single entity running the show. That's pretty wild to start recognizing. And second, you start to notice that, I just call them these proto-eyes or pro-eyes, the apparent self that arises in the mind. And you look closely, you know, it's different, but it's kind of variable. It's not always the same self. That's claiming that it's it has a different quality characteristics. And you also see more clearly that even though embedded in any activation or appearance of presumption implicitly, thinking but you never find the whole self. You never find this whole self that is presumed ever present in its entirety. And that starts helping you take life less personally, be less defensive, be more relaxed, be less aggressive, not taking yourself so seriously, and not privileging the adamant demands that presume you inside of you. And then last, in terms of how mindfulness can really change, and really change our sense of self, is that as we become more aware of ourselves, and more able to sustain steadiness in mind, our attention is more and more drawn to the nature of ourselves. Not the context of the sound, the sensation, the memory, more and more we become aware of just sort of the fabric of the fabric. And it starts feeling and meaning increasingly more. It starts having more of a sense of independence than you have to do substantial reality or essence. And it is there. It's existing. Just because it's empty of some kind of absolute essence, it's still existing. But it feels increasingly transient, made up of so many parts, so many threads. You start, you know, the tapestry. It's like when you step back, it looks like the king and queen hunting in the village or something like that. Or it's a picture. But when you get closer and closer and closer, you start seeing a separate thread. And the presumed thing that's there starts deconstructing, that changes more and more your sense of being. The more and more you experience yourself to be, as Walt Whitman said 150 years ago, I am multiple. And what happens when people go there, unless they've got some vulnerability to psychosis, so be careful, as I think it was Jack Engler, who said, you got to be somebody before you can become nobody. So there needs to be initially this kind of coherence, including developmentally in their childhood. But over time, as people deepen in this recognition of the foaminess and ongoingness and intertwining of allness of experience, they actually become nicer, happier, lighter, and more loving. So it's a good thing. Okay, those are the big four. Mindfulness helps us, follows other pathways as well, but there's a lot of research evidence for these four, helping us get regulation of our attention, our most fundamental property, helps us get more tuned into our bodies and therefore ourselves and therefore other people, helps us regulate our emotions and desires better, and fourth, helps gradually shifting our sense of self. Good stuff. Okay, questions or comments? Every so often I think there's a place for just a good summary letter. There you have it. That's it. So if you're somebody wakes you up at 3 a.m. and says, okay, come on, what is this mindfulness theory? Why does it work? You go, well, there's 4 major ways. Huh. What do you mean dissolution of negativity? What do you mean by negativity? What did I talk about that was the falling away of negativity specifically? What are you referring to? Okay, yeah, that's right. That is right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, and deconditioning, counterconditioning, the whole thing. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, isn't that interesting? Yeah, yeah. And I, if I could, I'd like to add a couple things to that. So obviously, if we go negative on negative, there's just more negative. There is suffering. First and foremost, we need to be with what arises and not get, you know, all manipulative about it on the one hand. On the other hand, we would wish for our friend that our friend would fear less, not be so sad, not be so hurt, not be so angry, not feel so inadequate. We would wish for that to decrease, right? And we would wish for our friend to feel increasingly grateful and contented and calm and strong and happy and loved and loving. We would wish that. So it's perfectly appropriate to have a wholesome desire. If it's wholesome for that being, it would be wholesome for this being as well. We have to be skillful about that. You know, wholesome ends pursued with wholesome means without attachment to the results. And that said, there's a place for wholesome desire. Okay. So in that framework then, what I was referring to was one of the findings about over time, people, on average, with some exceptions, sometimes when people open into themselves through mindfulness, they open the trap door to hell. It's not a panacea. It's important to be resourced and to be careful about it, particularly a deep immersion into kind of a naked confrontation with yourself, like in a long silent meditation retreat with someone who's not very prepared for that. That's to be cautious about. But on the whole, it is true, number one, that it's found routinely that people develop what's called distress tolerance through sustained contemplative practice. In this case, I'm talking about a subset of that, which is mindfulness practice, typically in a secular frame with a strong emphasis on mindfulness of the body. It's generally what these studies are about, what the research is about. But it has implications for other forms of practice, including in non-secular, more theistic, transcendental, religious, prayerful modes of contemplative practice. So a second pathway, in addition to being able to tolerate discomfort without acting it out, having more shock absorbers inside yourself. A second thing that I could have added in terms of emotion regulation, very reliable finding, is that people who practice mindfulness have increased activation on the left prefrontal cortex compared to right prefrontal cortex. Why that matters, and this is for right-handed people, half of all lefties, it's just reversed, same thing, is that the left prefrontal cortex is very involved in the regulation of negative emotion, and the left prefrontal cortex supports what's called an approach orientation rather than an avoidance orientation. It supports more of promoting the opportunity, promoting the good, in proportion to preventing the bad of the threat. Now, obviously, it's important to pull your hand back from a hot stove for the kid out of rushing traffic before the bus comes around the corner. There's a place for that. But on the whole, studies do show that an approach orientation and what's called related to that, a promotion focus rather than a prevention focus, is also associated with positive emotion and various other beneficial things, like bouncing back from stress, health promotion practices. You know, happy people literally live several years longer causally due to happiness, not just because when your health's better, you get happy, you know, which is understandable, but the ways in which happiness itself has a causative influence over the lifespan. There's that. That's pretty good. And then third point, very often when we meditate, we, you know, when we're actually meditating rather than just working our, you know, to-do list in our head, I admit it, or, you know, working through some issue with some other person, we're often dwelling in a nice place, a relatively calm, a relatively peaceful. I look around the room, one of the sweetest things for me is when I ring the bell when we're done, I get to see your faces. I open my eyes, I look at you. You look better than you did when you walked in the door. I probably do too. I hope I do. A little bit at least. You know, we're kind of, it's a peaceful abiding. You know, we're in a nice place. That's good, and neurons that fire together wire together. You know, if we're marinating in some kind of beneficial, emotionally positive place, even fairly mild, just still nice, tranquility is a beautiful thing there. If we're marinating in that, if we gradually absorb it, and then it's fun. Or to use the traditional saying, the mind takes its shape from what it repeatedly does. And modern upgrade would be the brain takes it from what we repeatedly wrestle. So we're wrestling upon wholesome states of mind. And to finish, in the epitome of all of that, when we're doing concentration practice, and often there's a fair amount of joy and bliss that arise. The Buddha described rapture or bliss as one of the seven factors of awakening. No small thing, you know, for someone who is completely prepared to do really serious ascetic practices. So sometimes what we do is we rest our mind in compassion or kindness or really strong, powerful, positive emotions, joy, bliss, intense gratitude, wonderful peace, and so forth. Well, guess what? If we rest our minds on those emotional positive things, they gradually become our own. I mean, if Merck or Pfizer could patent meditation, we'd be seeing as many ads for it as for, you know, Prozac or Zoloft. We'd still see a lot of ads for Viagra and its equivalents, but, you know, anyway. Okay, any other comments, questions? About 5 more minutes, great. Question/comment. Briefly, if you just Google negativity bias as a phrase, you'll pull up dozens, maybe hundreds of studies of it. And one of the great literature reviews, because it's interesting to read, you know, and it's well written, is called Bad is Stronger Than Good. So if you just kind of remember that, bad is stronger than good. It's not bad, it's better than good. It's a great question. You may know this acronym. The primary objects of research, social science research, are WEIRD, right? Western, educated, industrial, R for rich, I think, and democracy. I think something like that. So, yeah, they tend to be Western. But in general, I don't know about cross-cultural studies. I'm sure that matters, but animal studies, non-human animal studies. So we're not dealing with East versus West culture, let's say, or North versus South, contrast in culture. We all share the same nervous system, you know. Whatever you think of the ethics of non-human animal research, it's a very robust finding that animals learn faster from pain than from pleasure. Animals tend to be continually vigilant. I look out my window, I see birds on the ground, you know, squirrels in the tree. They're constantly feeling pretty bad. And the basic idea, you're right, is that we, as our ancestors evolved, we needed to pursue carrots, food, eating opportunities, pleasure, and so forth. But they also needed to avoid sticks, predators, hazards, aggression, and moving in between days, pain at various times. And the difference is that if you fail to get that reward today, the carrot, you probably have a chance to come along. But if you fail to avoid that hazard, think about the mortality rate in hunter-gatherer cultures for children is 5 out of 6 are typically dead by their 6th birthday. You know, it's really pretty intense. And when you have that much of a mortality pressure, you get a lot of selection around very small things that increase your odds, even slightly, of living to see the sunrise, or keeping your kids alive to see the sunrise so they can pass on things and so forth. So, sticks have more urgency and impact than carrots do. There's a loss of that. Now, there are exceptions to negativity bias. I think something like 89% of the teenagers in America are certain they will become either a rock star or a professional athlete. You know, seriously. So there are examples of this. And there are ways in which people discount negative events and so forth. But a lot of that is about what people say they think, but emotionally and what they do. People tend to be organized around, you know, first and foremost, you know, doing the work. So what to do about it? I'm struck often by the ways in which our resting state is fundamentally peaceful, contented, and loving. That's our resting state. That's the resting state of a zebra or a cat or a dog. And when you feel your core needs in that, you stop stressing, you stop fighting and fussing. You know, if you do, most people. A few people who shall be nameless and politics continue to be real jerks even when they have $1 billion. But most people, from my observation, most people of all strata, including lovely people, tend to default a really peaceful place. It's a good place. It's not a waste, but it's a good place. On the other hand, in this way in which biology operates, in this often this kind of push, pull, break, gas pedal way, including in our nervous system, excitation, inhibition, kind of way, it's quite dynamic. That resting state is balanced by the very rapid way we move into fight, flight, or freeze to deal with immediate threats, and then overlearn from that experience. Never forget, once burned, twice shot. And so for me, one of the takeaways is to realize and honor our own biology. We are a body full of mind, trying to be mindful of body. Right? Our bodies are the mind, to be inside the natural, whatever's outside of what's transcendental, supernatural, and so forth, whatever that might be, but inside the natural brain, the causes are streaming through our body. Whether it's a squirrel or a zebra, a cat, a monkey, a stone-age person, or us. And so, the takeaway is to appreciate that these bodies evolved to crave and suffer, often to survive, and we're vulnerable there. And we live in a time where we often don't have to worry about gross threats, like saber-toothed tigers charging and all the rest, but we're exposed to lots of mild to moderate disturbances of threat, you know, alarm messages, or reward messages, or issues bumping up against strangers or other people, you know, that rattles. And so for me, the takeaway is to get on our own side, recognize the level of the challenge, and repeatedly internalize beneficial experiences that build resources inside us, so we get increasingly peaceful and contented and loving, no matter how big the challenge is. I'll finish on this point. A teacher in Southeast Asia, U Pandita, Pandita's last name, has this wonderful line. It says, the purpose of practice is to expand the range of experiences in which we're free. Expand the range of internal material in which we're free. Stuff will come up. You know, our backs will hurt. Our children will move away. Our parents will pass away. Things will happen. We'll get bad news in the mail, right? Things will happen. We'll have some reward, right, dangled in front of us that we want. Or we had it, but it's gradually fading away. Your book is no longer number one on Amazon or something, you know. As a surgeon client of mine said, all bleeding stops eventually, Rick, one way or another. You know? Right, what are we going to do about it? And so to me, it's to build up reserves inside, if you will, shock absorbers, or mixing my metaphor, a keel in the water for your inner sailboat, so that you can retain that fundamental freedom in your relationship to whatever is occurring around you or inside you. And repeatedly practicing mindfulness directly increases your freedom in relationship to that, and directly grows resources inside you that help you deepen your freedom, your liberation in relationship to experiences, so you can sustain your core of well-being in peace and contentment and love no matter what. And mindfulness is also a great tool to bring to be able to draw upon, also to help you be more and more stably peaceful, loving, and happy. And that's a darn good thing.
He said
Buddhist practice, but you could generalize. It's to expand the range. Yeah, it's easy to be free when someone's brushing your hair, another person's giving you a pedicure. Not that I've ever had that experience ever, but whatever. You know, that's straightforward. Everybody loves you. It's all wonderful. But what happens when, you know, normal life unfolds? Yeah. Okay. So may you be mindful and may you cultivate mindfulness with some kind of regular practice, a minute or more a day. It's my personal vow, and I encourage you to take the same one. How about we just sit for a minute and then we'll finish up, okay? You might even notice it with sounds right now. The sounds themselves might feel disturbing or there's something there, but awareness itself is never disturbed. Your mindful awareness is stable. Things pass through it, but it itself is stable. Thank you for your mindful presence tonight. Thank you. See you next week. Take care.